We have a report next on revolution, ego, passion, backstabbing, fierce competition, and beauty. It's the story of ballet in the 20th century as told in a new documentary called Ballet Russe. Iris Mann reports.
The names of the Ballet Russe dancers and choreographers are legendary in the dance world. Danilova, Fokine, Balanchine, Nijinsky. Irina Baranova is a former prima ballerina who offers a few more names you might recognize.
Picasso, Dalí, Chagall, Miró, you name them. They all collaborated with us and designed our sceneries and costumes.
Baranova was one of three girls in their early teens dubbed the Baby Ballerinas and chosen by George Balanchine to be the stars of the new Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo in 1932. She says another well-known artist who designed sets and costumes for the company was Henri Matisse.
He would do a sketch and then say, oh, I don't quite like it, and throw it into the waste paper basket. If only I could have been smart and pick it up. Oh, what a collection I would have had now.
It was a remarkable moment in time. Igor Stravinsky composed music specifically for the Ballet Russe. In 1937, the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo broke into two companies. The split made headlines, and what came to be known as the Ballet Wars began. The rival companies vied for dancers, choreographers, and audiences. During the next season in London, they were booked around the corner from each other, one at Covent Garden, the other at Drury Lane.
Even the taxi drivers were taking part in this, because some of our friends said that they'd get into a taxi and say, to Drury Lane. And the taxi driver would say, oh, you want to see the Russian ballet? No, no, you want to go to Covent Garden.
All of this was unknown to filmmakers Dan Geller and Dana Goldfein before they began their documentary, Ballet Russe. A friend of a friend was helping organize a reunion of the dancers in New Orleans 5 years ago, and Geller says they decided to shoot it.
It became clear as we got into the film further and further that we really wanted to make a movie that someone might go to, sit down saying, I don't know about this ballet stuff, and then walk out saying, my God, I'd love to go to see ballet, and what an amazing story. And also this film ultimately is as much about aging, having done something beautiful in your life, as it is about a particular art form.
The filmmakers went on to shoot nearly 90 hours of interviews with the surviving dancers. Geller says the editing process became a tug of war between the tangled web of events and the fascinating characters who lived them. One of these was Frederick Franklin. Speaking from New York, he recalls touring in 1938 and introducing audiences in small towns across America to ballet. One night they finished a performance to dead silence.
And there was a reception after. And I remember talking to one of the ladies and I said, you know, you must have hated this performance tonight. I said, well, you know, generally, if you like something, you sort of applaud. Oh, the lady said, oh, no, Mr. Franklin, we didn't want to spoil the atmosphere. It was all so beautiful.
Franklin remembers performing in 110 cities in 5 months, many of the shows one-night stands. Mark Platt was one of the first Americans to join the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo and was forced to Russianize his name to Platoff. Today, he says the schedule was crazy.
We would perform in any city, say Cleveland, and we were through. We would all then go to a major hotel ballroom. Now, this was 11, 12 at night. And they would rehearse us for an hour or two. We would be freed then to go to the train. We were always on a train. So we would go to the train, collapse into the bunk, and about 6 o'clock in the morning, somebody would grab the sheets by our feet and wake us up. And we were going to be, again, rehearsing. And then in the afternoon or evening, we would perform. And after that performance, we would go back to another ballroom somewhere and rehearse again. That was before unions, God bless them, and before this sort of thing could be stopped.
During those tours, dancers would sometimes get off the caravan and set up shop, says filmmaker Dana Goldfein.
All of a sudden, there are little companies that sprung up. Some Ballet Russe dancer would, you know, fall in love with a city and end up staying on. Or lo and behold, dancers fell in love with people in Australia and they fell in love with the country and they stayed behind. And today we have the Australian Ballet, which very, very openly acknowledges its debt to the Ballet Russe. So the lovely thing about the hard travels that they did is that they left behind the seeds of ballet as we know it today.
Goldfein marvels at how many of the Ballet Russe alumni continued to perform and teach well into their 70s, 80s, and even their 90s. The film shows former baby ballerina Tatiana Rabushinska at age 83 conducting class in a West Hollywood studio.
Good. Rendez-vous par terre. That I don't have to show you. Eight front, eight back, four dégagé back, and four dégagé front. Three.
Four. Why do you still teach?
Well, because what will I do? Sell books? Sell fruit? So that's my life, you know?
Ultimately, the Ballet Russe companies folded, one in 1948 and the other in 1962, and they've been largely forgotten by the public. That's why Irina Baranova believes the documentary is so important.
To have a documentary about our company and the dancers of that era, which is last century, we were from the last century, aren't we? It's terribly important, and thank God it was made then, because since then, a lot of people that you see in the documentary, like Rybushinska, Slavenska, Krasovska, they're all dead. They died all soon after, one after the other, you know? The queue by the pearly gates is getting very short.
We were a tribe, says Baranova. We had great camaraderie, and we made history. For NPR News, this is Iris Mann in Los Angeles.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee's with you tomorrow on Thanksgiving. I'm Steve Inskeep.